We could do announcements again and go home. By the way, I forgot to welcome those of you watching on the webcast here this afternoon. For you, it probably doesn't look any different at all than from what we typically have had on the Sabbath. But for the rest of us in the hall, it's a very different setting. So we're glad to have you join us, be with us, and especially those who are our local members who are not able to be here today. Hope to see you all again very soon. Well, as you know, my wife and I recently returned from a family vacation in which we visited some parts of southern Alaska. We flew into Anchorage, and from Anchorage we went out down to some of the highways nearby to travel up into the mountains. We saw some of the glaciers, hiked some of the trails to get closer to the foot of the glaciers. We saw some amazing sights. It was kind of frustrating because every time you would kind of turn a little bit, you'd hit the mic. And then right after that, there was another picture. You couldn't take enough pictures to try to capture the beauty and the magnificence of what we were seeing. It's just such a tremendous and spectacular place. I know many of you have been there for the Feast of Tabernacles and know what that scene is. But it's just such a place that's almost beyond description. And we brought home a lot of pictures, but still, like I said, it doesn't really capture the beauty, the richness of the natural resources that we see in that one location as part of the United States. Most of you have traveled, if not there, to many other places within our nation that are beautiful. We're so richly blessed with an amazing nation that we live in. The feast sites that you've gone to are likely areas that come to mind as places you've been that have been very special to visit because of their beauty, because of their the grandeur of those areas, places in Utah, Arizona, South Dakota, South Carolina, Alabama. All over the nation we have gone to travel and seen just beautiful sights. And again, it's difficult, even when you go and travel and see those things, to fully appreciate how richly God has blessed this nation and what an amazing place it is for us to live. How did that come to be? Many people now would have us be ashamed of the success and the power of the United States. Many people would turn us against our own history. But how do we get to be the nation that we are and to enjoy the blessings that we have? When you look around the world with the way that other nations, things they're dealing with, their conditions, you'd have to say, you know, we won the genetic lottery. To be born in this nation, and even at this age or this time in this nation, is just something very special. To be part of, to witness, to be able to enjoy the wealthiest and strongest nation in history. How did it get to be this way? There's a distinct difference between the descendants of Abraham through Isaac and the other nations in this world. Through Isaac and Jacob, Abraham's descendants have had the power, wealth, and influence that has dominated and shaped the world that we live in, just as it was promised all the way back in Genesis 12. When God began working in the life of Abraham. And when we look back at what's happened over the millennia, it's amazing to consider how God has fulfilled the physical promises that he made to Abraham and how he expanded those promises on a spiritual level through the seed of Abraham, meaning Jesus Christ. It is through Abraham and his family that God has provided these amazing world-shaping and world-changing nations through his prophecies. We've begun a series of sermons to consider the conditions that exist in the Middle East and how they got to be that way. And we're looking ahead to considering prophecies about that part of the world as well. We began by considering the mix of peoples and cultures that developed in that part of the world. Prophecy reveals that at the end of this age, there will be circumstances and conditions right there in the Middle East that will have serious impact on all the rest of the world. In a previous sermon, we saw that Canaan, the area of Canaan, was populated by descendants of Ham initially, many of whom were called Canaanites. And it also included people called the Philistines. We also read and learned that there are four different lines of descendants that come from Abraham, from his family. One being the sons of his nephew Lot. Then there are the sons of his wife Keturah, who were sent to the east away from the rest of the family. The family of Ishmael, who is actually Abraham's firstborn son. And the family of Esau, his grandson. But God promised, in particular, that the descendants of Abraham through Isaac would inherit Canaan as an everlasting possession. Today, we're going to continue this series that I've titled Origins of the Middle East Crisis. The title of today's sermon is Israel Enters the Promised Land. Last time, we reviewed the story of Esau and Jacob. We saw that God had revealed to Rebekah that Jacob would dominate his older brother. But rather than leaving it in God's hands, Jacob extorted the birthright blessing from Esau, taking advantage of him in a weak moment. And then he and his mother plotted to deceive Isaac into giving the family blessing to Jacob as well. So after being taken advantage of and left without any meaningful blessing, Esau intended to kill Jacob after Isaac died. Rebekah sent Jacob away to live with her brother Laban. And that's where we will pick up the story today. We'll see how God used and caused circumstances to begin to fulfill his covenant promise to Abraham. And we'll also see how that created hostility and conflict in this region of the world that continues to today. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, history is sometimes a bit challenging to study. This afternoon, my plan is to go through quite a bit, several hundred years of history in a pretty short time. I don't mean to go too quickly so that we lose track of where we are, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on details. We want to stay focused on the development of the family of Abraham and how they arrived in the land of Canaan. So we'll move fairly quickly and just summarize some of the major events that are taking place. We begin in Genesis chapter 28. Genesis chapter 28, verses 1 and 2. Genesis 28, verses 1 and 2. This was when Rebekah had sent, was going to send Jacob away to be with her family. Isaac called Jacob, verse 1, Genesis 28, and blessed him and charged him and said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise and go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take yourself a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." When Jacob fled, Isaac gave him a charge. That means a command or an order. Isaac ordered Jacob to not take a wife from the people of the land, but rather from the family of Laban. And then in verses 3 and 4, he repeats again the blessing that he had given to him earlier. And it's similar to blessings that God had pronounced on Abraham. Verse 3, "May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may be an assembly of peoples, and give you the blessing of Abraham to you and your descendants with you, that you may inherit the land in which you are a stranger, which God gave to Abraham. Those are powerful words of a blessing that were to come upon Jacob and his descendants. In verses 13 through 15, as Jacob was traveling, he had a vision in which God again repeated the blessing and the prophecy of his greatness. Verse 13, the Eternal stood above him and said, I am the Eternal God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. Also, your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west, to the east, to the north, to the south, and in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. Again, a very powerful promise given to Jacob about the blessings that he would receive and the future of his family. It's basically a repetition, again, of the birthright and blessing that were given to him. It's interesting that God honored the promise he had made, even though Jacob had not been a very good citizen. The promise was there that he would receive these promises, but he jumped in along with his mother and got ahead of God and kind of made some of these things happen on their own, on their effort, and caused some complications for Jacob and his family. Still, God honored his promise to bless the seed of Abraham through Jacob. So we're going to skim very quickly over much of the history here of the family of Jacob. In chapter 29, we see that Jacob was tricked into marrying Leah. He worked 7 years so that he could marry Rachel. Laban pulled a fast one at the wedding ceremony and switched on him, and he wound up marrying Leah first, and then a week later, they arranged for him to go ahead and marry Rachel, but he had to work another 7 years to earn her as his bride. So Laban was not a very trustworthy man. Chapter 30, we see the birth of Jacob's sons. 11 sons are listed here that are born to Jacob and his wives. The 12th son, Benjamin, was born sometime later when Jacob was on his way back to his home. But here we see the birth of 11 of his 12 sons. In chapter 31, we'll slow down just a little bit and see that Jacob fell out of favor with Laban. Jacob heard the words, chapter 31, verse 1, of Laban's sons, who were speaking against him, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has acquired all his wealth. And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you. So there was some body language happening here. Laban just was not, it was clear that he was not favorable toward Jacob, and that he was beginning to feel that he was being taken advantage of. In chapter 32, verse 26, Jacob is on his way back to his family, and after spending 20 years working for Laban, and we have kind of a mysterious scene here involving Jacob, but it was a significant event, a direct confirmation from God of his covenant promises to Jacob. Chapter 32, verse 22. Jacob arose that night and took his wives and female servants and 11 sons and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. He took them and sent them over the brook and over to sent over what he had for them. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now when he saw, that is, the man wrestling with him, that he did not prevail against Jacob, He touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." Jacob was wrestling with, as we understand it, the one who would become Jesus Christ. And he had appeared to Jacob to, in a sense, test him, and also to reveal to him another special milestone in Jacob's life. Jacob proved, in this instance, his tenacity and his determination, that he recognized that this was not just another man, but someone spiritual in nature who could offer him a very special blessing. And we see after this event takes place what is apparently a change in Jacob's heart, perhaps even his character. Verses 27 and 28, this individual said to Jacob, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." God here in this instant changes another man's name. Remember, Abram was changed to Abraham. Now Jacob's name is being changed to Israel. He was still called Jacob as we continue the story, but Israel became basically the covenant name that God gave to him. And it reflected the promises of the covenant that God had made. The Companion Bible defines the name Israel as meaning God commands, orders, or rules. This was a lesson for Jacob, because remember, he was aggressive, he was a supplanter, he was one who would take over in a situation and force his will. He was being taught by this experience that it is God who sets things as he wills them to be. He makes the rules. The Kyle and Deletes Bible commentary on the Old Testament says that the word translated Israel means God's fighter. Jacob, in a sense, began now fighting for God rather than against God, trying to impose his own will. Another website called BibleStudyTools.com says that the name Israel is a compound of the two words wrestle and God. This fact that Jacob used his tenacity and his energy to insist that God give him a blessing says a lot about his character, and also his acknowledgement that God was again the one who would give the blessing. Jacob had been a very crafty schemer, a manipulator, a fighter. And here he is struggling with the one who became Jesus Christ, knowing that it was a special situation, and he would not stop until he received a blessing from him. It says that he struggled with God and prevailed. The word prevailed would be better translated endured. He set his mind, his heart, to seek that blessing from the one he realized could provide the blessing, and he wasn't going to quit without it. So God, in this case, then again extended that blessing to Jacob and reassigned him the name Israel, which reminded Jacob of the fact that God is in charge and God would be the one who would make the rules and set the order of things. So Jacob at this point is on his way home again from living with Laban and his family, taking with him his wives and his family, his children. In chapter 36, again we'll skip through some of the details here, Esau and Jacob met. God had calmed Esau down so that they met peacefully and went their separate ways. Chapter 35, Jacob is returning to his homeland. Notice in chapter 35, verse 1, God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother." This goes back to the time when Jacob first left his home, and he was given a special vision and a blessing, promising him success as he, and that he would return to his homeland. But notice verse 2. Interesting point. Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves." Put away the foreign gods that are among you. Even among Jacob's household, there were those who continued to worship other gods. The God of Israel, the God of Abraham and Isaac, now the God of Jacob, was not one that was recognized by all of those, even in Jacob's own household. But he commanded that they put those things away. The promise again is repeated in chapter 35, verse 9. God appeared to Jacob again when he was leaving from Padan Aram, and he said, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name." And he also called his name Israel. And God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and company of nations shall proceed from you, and the kings shall come from your body. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, I give to you, and to your descendants after you, I give the land." The promises are made continually throughout the lives of Abraham and now Jacob, that God will give this land to the descendants of Jacob. Chapter 36 kind of interrupts the story flow, and it gives us a little overview of the genealogy of Jacob's brother, Esau. This is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom. Verses 1 through 5 go on to list the immediate sons of Esau, and then verses 6 through 8 indicate where he took his family to live outside of Canaan. Esau took his wives, his sons, daughters, and all the persons of his household, his cattle and animals, and all his goods which he had gained in the land of Canaan, and he went to a country away from the presence of his brother Jacob. Just as had been prophesied or predicted, Esau separated himself physically from the presence of Jacob. At that time, he was had his own wealth, but he did not have the same blessing that God had extended to Jacob, didn't have the same future that God had promised to Jacob, and he moved out of the area, and he says he dwelt in Mount Seir, which is south of Canaan and to the east of Canaan, and it says that Esau is Edom. Esau is the ancestor of the Edomites. So you find Edom in prophecy at the end of the age. I won't read it now, but you can go to the book of Obadiah. Obadiah delivered a short prophecy of Edom's punishment at the end of the age for their mistreatment of Israel and Judah. So this contention between Jacob and Esau was abated somewhat during their lifetime, but their descendants were enemies of and were harsh toward the nation of Israel and Judah. From chapter 37 on, we have to all the way to the end of the book of Genesis, we see the story of Jacob's family. It's a story that I think you're probably familiar with. Jacob's son Joseph was sold to slave traders by his brothers. And God used that circumstance, or dealt with the circumstances that Joseph was in, so that he rose to a powerful position in Egypt. And he was entrusted with preparing Egypt for a 7-year drought and famine. That famine affected all of the area, all of the region, We turn back to chapter 45 and 46. We find here that Jacob's brothers came to Egypt seeking relief from the famine. Eventually, Joseph revealed himself to them. And in chapter 46, we find that God brought Jacob's family into Egypt. Verse 1, Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night, and he said, "Here I am." And so he said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will surely bring you up again. Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. His beloved son, whom he thought was dead, would once again be reunited with his father." But the promise from God is that Jacob should take his family and go down to Egypt, and that in that location, God would make them a great nation. You know, it seems like a step backward when you consider it. They were promised the land of Canaan, but now they're moving out of Canaan to go into Egypt. Obviously, God did that for the purpose of putting his family in a place where they could grow into a nation. He was preparing the nation of Israel for their future. Jacob and his family moved into Egypt in 1682 B.C. That was when this took place. 1682 B.C., Joseph brought his father, his brothers, and their families into Egypt, where they would initially be safe from the famine, but God's intent was that at that location, they would grow into a nation. They remained in Egypt for 239 years. It was 1443 B.C. when they left, that was the time of the Exodus. They were delivered from Egypt in 1443 B.C. So the nation of, or the people of Israel were in Egypt for 239 years. And it was there that they grew in population to the extent that they could be a nation. Exodus chapter 1 describes the growth of the people of Jacob's family, who would become the nation of Israel. Verse 1, Exodus chapter 1, these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. And it lists the sons then and their households. Verse 5, all those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. 70 people of Jacob's family moved to Egypt, and that was where, that was the seed from which the nation of Israel was to grow. Verse 6, Joseph died and all his brothers and all their generation, but the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. As time passed, the first generation, Joseph and his family and his brothers and their families died, but the people continued to develop and grow in numbers. And they maintained their identity. You see that from the story as it unfolds. They were slaves in Egypt and held there because the leaders of Egypt were fearful that they could turn against them. So they oppressed them severely and kept them as slaves and were very harsh and cruel toward them. Then we know, of course, that Moses was sent to deliver them out of Egypt. So the point is, again, that God was developing his nation. And he now, as we read the story of the Exodus, is preparing to bring them back from Egypt into Canaan so they would receive their inheritance, the land that God had promised to them. Exodus chapter 6, we see the promise that is made to them, which is based on the covenant God made with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. Exodus chapter 6. The Lord said to Moses, "Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand he will let them go, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land." And God spoke to Moses and said to him, "I am the Eternal. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, as God Almighty, but by name, my name, Lord or Eternal, I was not known to them." What it means is that he was not known as the covenant God, but he would be known as that to the people of Israel. "I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, in which they were strangers. And I've also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage. And I've remembered my covenant. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am the Eternal. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm with great judgments. I will take you as my people. I will be your God. Then you shall know that I am the Eternal, your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Eternal. I am Yahweh." The promises that were made long before were now going to be fulfilled, now that there is a nation of Israelites to move into that land. They started out as 70 people, but now, some 200 years later, 200 years plus, they are at least 2 to 3 million in number. Remember when they came out of Egypt, it was said that there were 600,000 men, along with their wives and children. Typical family size, you could easily see that that would represent at least 3 million people who would be coming out of Egypt to go to take the land that God had promised to them. We're not going to go through the plagues and the miraculous escape of Israel, but we want to continue to follow Israel as they move out of Egypt into the land of Canaan. The route that they took led them into the Sinai wilderness. They camped at Mount Sinai for a year. During that year, after they left Egypt, God established his covenant with them, which was based on the promises he had made to Abraham. You read through the book of Exodus. During that first year, they built the tabernacle, and God was teaching them who he was and what it meant to be his nation. The people of Israel needed to know who God even was. For 239 years, they'd lived in Egypt, much of that in a severe situation of slavery, and they needed to know who this God was who was rescuing them. God took a whole year to get them established. I think it's interesting to consider the book of Leviticus. You know, Leviticus is not dated. At the end of Exodus, you see that the Israelites were in at that Mount Sinai for a year. Then you skip ahead to Numbers, and it's pretty much the same time as it was when you finished the book of Exodus. Leviticus is in between. Leviticus is not dated. Leviticus is most likely the instruction that Israel received. It's kind of a handbook, how to be God's people. In Leviticus, you find the sacrificial system introduced. You find the holy days. You find meats that are clean and unclean. You find the Sabbath. You find the institution of tithing. All this is part of the book of Leviticus. Israel was going to school, learning what it meant to be God's people. They had lost track of that during their slavery. And now God was bringing them to be his people. And remember, Peter quotes from the book of Leviticus, "Be holy, for I am holy." That was what Israel was being taught during this year they were at Mount Sinai, while God was working with them to prepare them to move on to Canaan. The story flow that we're following picks up in chapter 9 of Numbers. Numbers chapter 9. In Numbers chapter 9 through 12, we find several locations that Israel traveled to after they left Mount Sinai. Until finally, in Numbers chapter 13, they come to the land of Canaan. This was the first time they had come to Canaan. This was about 17 or 18 months after they left Egypt. They'd spent a year at Mount Sinai being taught, and then they traveled for the next few months until they finally reached the southern border of Canaan. We know in chapter 13 of Numbers that God told Moses to send men in to spy out the land, to check it out, to come back with a report to the people about the land that God had given to them. We'll read the summary of what they reported in verses 27 through 33. I'll read this from the New International Version. The spies came back and they said to Moses, "We went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit." They brought back some samples of what was growing in the land. So that was, they saw the land and it was beautiful. It was rich. It was everything God had said it was going to be. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. Remember, we mentioned earlier on that the people of Canaan had hundreds of years to establish themselves in this land. And when the spies from Israel went in to check it out and to come back and give a report, they saw this land with cities that are fortified and large. The Amalekites live in the Negev in the south part. The Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites, all these Canaanites live throughout the land. And the spies were terrified at what they saw. Caleb, verse 20, quieted the people and said to them, "Let's go up at once and take possession." Caleb realized or had faith that God would deliver them. But verse 31, the men who had gone up with him said, "No, we can't attack these people. They're stronger than we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. And they said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of giants." Well, that was an exaggeration. But they were fearful of what they saw. "We saw Nephilim, the descendants of Anak, and we felt like grasshoppers in our own eyes." So there were some people there who were fierce, who were strong, perhaps much larger than they were. They called them giants, Nephilim. And they were afraid to go into the land. And of course, we know they refused. Chapter 14, verses 1 through 4, I won't read this necessarily, but when the people of Israel saw what they were up against, they panicked. But we have to consider what Canaan looked like from their perspective. For hundreds of years, this land had been claimed by the Canaanites, occupied by them, and developed by them. They were fierce and warlike. But up until just 18 months prior to this, the Israelites were a passive and peaceful people who were slaves in Egypt. They had no experience in warfare. They probably had few, if any, weapons, and no hope of standing up against these people who were occupied the land. Verses 20 through 23 continues this same thought and the fear that they had as they considered the land. Verse 20, the Lord said, "I have pardoned..." Okay. The spies saw that they were fierce and intimidating, and people balked at going into the land. But again, now from God's perspective, he realized that after all that he had done for them to bring them out of Egypt, within just the last few months, all that they had experienced, the powerful hand of God destroying the greatest nation on earth so they could escape, and now they were not willing to go into Canaan. They didn't trust God to deliver them from the Canaanites so that they could establish their nation. So God, of course, as we know, sentenced them to 40 years in the wilderness until that first generation who had balked at going into Canaan would die off, and the next generation would go into the land that God had promised to them. I'm going to skip ahead now to the time when they actually did enter the land, some 38 and a half years later, Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 1. Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 1. Deuteronomy is a review of God's laws and commands that was given to the second generation, those who lived in the wilderness and would go into the promised land. Its purpose is to prepare them to enter the land. And in Deuteronomy 20, we see general instructions regarding how Israel would need to be prepared. They'd need to be strong, they need to have courage, they'd have to be willing to fight for the country that God was giving to them. Deuteronomy chapter 20, we'll just read verse 1. When you go out to battle against your enemies, and you see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Eternal, your God, is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. They would have to have courage and strength to go forward into the land that God had promised them. In verses 16 and 17 in this chapter, we see specific instructions for conquering the land. Verse 16, Deuteronomy 20. Of the cities of these peoples, which the Eternal your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive. You shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. Just as the Eternal your God has commanded you, they are to completely destroy everything and everyone in those cities. That is brutal. Those are the commands given to Israel by a God of love. God was heartless and cruel toward these people who lived in the land. What kind of a God is this? What is he telling them to do? Well, we continue in verse 18 and we see the reason for this being the case. Lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations, which they have done for their gods, and you sin against the Eternal, your God. The reason that Israel was to enter the land and destroy completely the entire culture and the people of that land was for their own protection. These are God's people. Again, be holy, for I am holy. Don't allow any vestige of the Canaanite culture to remain so that you will not be seduced by it and brought into it. That was what Israel was told to do to these nations, these Canaanites who had established themselves in that land. By the way, we should note that the Canaanites never formed actually a nation. They were a group of what we would call city-states. There were numerous cities you read of in the book of Joshua that the people of Israel conquered. Each one had its own ruler, called him a king. Each one had their own army. Each one was independent. There was not really a nation of Canaanites, but there were individual tribes and cities and locations that Israel was to go into and conquer and exterminate. Now, at this point, I want to make one important clarification regarding the people that are mentioned here. God is not saying, I would not say, that everyone who comes from a Middle Eastern descent or heritage is an evil or inferior person. We have members in our church whose roots are in this part of the world and whose ethnicity goes back to the peoples that are populating the area of the world at this time. The church does not condemn all those who are from that ethnic or cultural background. The church, in fact, has a very long-standing, very positive relationship with the leaders of Jordan and have had good relationships with others in that part of the world. We know that on a personal level, Arabs and Israelis can and do live peacefully side by side together. What this is talking about here is a political and religious environment. It is the leaders of the Palestinian and Arab people who have caused the problems and the difficulties. The Middle East has become a complicated mix of political, social, religious, and cultural differences. And it is so entangled that it is humanly impossible to unravel and resolve. What God told Israel to do when they entered the land is not a blanket condemnation of anyone who is from that ethnic background, but it was dealing with the situation at hand so that God would be able to protect his people. For example, in Acts chapter 10, Peter baptized the first Gentiles into the church, and he's made the statement that it is clear that God is not unfair. He's not partial to anyone. There's no blanket condemnation of people because of their Gentile background or ethnicity. There is, in this part of the world, conflict and hostility, and it reflects the ancient prophecies of the peoples that would descend from Ishmael, Esau, and the Canaanites. And by the way, Abraham's descendants are not innocent in all these complications. Much of the difficulty in that part of the world has come from the mistakes of Abraham's descendants. So it's very important that we recognize that we don't, again, look down on or think of anyone with this kind of a background as an inferior or evil person. God has given dozens of prophecies about Gentiles receiving salvation. And he will work with those people in the future. We know that they're part of his plan. But his plan at this point for Israel was to secure the land and to eliminate any of the false teachings that would otherwise harm them as a nation. So we'll skip back ahead into the flow here of the story. Joshua chapter 11. Joshua chapter 11, we're jumping through the time when Israel came into the land and began to conquer it. Joshua chapter 11, verse 16. Thus Joshua took all this land, the mountain country, all the south, all the land of Goshen, the lowland, the Jordan plain, goes on to describe the regions or the areas that Joshua and Israel conquered as they came into Egypt. He captured their kings and struck them down and killed them. And Joshua made war a long time with all those kings, all the leaders of the Canaanite city-states. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. You may remember the story early on when Israel was coming into the land. A group of people who were afraid of the Israelites masqueraded as some who were vagabonds in the area, and they posed no harm to Israel, and so they made a peace covenant with them. Other than that one city, no one even attempted to make peace with Israel. All the others they took in battle, for it was of the Lord to harden their hearts that they should not come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them, and that they might receive no mercy, and that he might destroy them as the Eternal had commanded Moses. Again, the purpose for that was to provide protection for Israel from the culture and the false religion of those people. So Jacob, Joshua, we read here in chapter 11, was able to accomplish the job of securing the land of Canaan for the people of Israel. And even though he did, there were still some Canaanites who had not been driven out or destroyed. Chapter 13, verse 1. Joshua was old and advanced in years, and the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years, and there remains very much land yet to be possessed." And then it lists the areas that are still occupied by the Canaanites. However, they had made advancements far enough that verse 7, now it was time to divide the land to an inheritance to the 9 tribes and half-tribe of Manasseh. Enough of the land had been conquered that they now were going to establish the areas in Canaan where the various tribes would settle. Remember that 2 of the tribes and half of the tribe of Manasseh had decided to stay on the other side of the Jordan. And so they were going to divide the land then between the remaining tribes. Numbers 32, it says that Reuben and Gad wanted to stay on the other side of the Jordan rather than come into the area of Canaan. And so the land would be divided now between the remaining 9.5 tribes that came into the land of Canaan. There still was much to be done, even though they would now pause in the next several chapters here, describe the division of the land between the tribes of Israel. Notice chapter 21, verse 43. Chapter 21, verse 43. So the Lord gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it and dwelt in it. The Eternal gave them rest all around according to all that he had sworn to their fathers. And not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Eternal delivered all their enemies into their hand. Verse 45, not a word failed of any good thing which the Eternal had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass. God had done his part in establishing Israel in Canaan, just as he had promised to Abraham and later to Isaac and to Jacob. God did everything that he said that he would do. However, there still was work that the nation of Israel needed to do to remove the remaining Canaanites from the land. Judges chapter 1. Judges chapter 1. After the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" And the Eternal said, "Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand." So the war against the Canaanites continued. Each of the tribes lived in an area in which there still were Canaanites that needed to be dealt with. The job that they had was to finish that the war against them that God had sent them into. But notice, beginning in read a few excerpts here, verse 19. Judges 1, verse 19, says, "So the Eternal was with Judah, and they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron." They had better war equipment than Judah did, and they were not able to drive out all the Canaanites from the land that had been given to them. Notice verse 27. Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of villages that are listed here. Manasseh did not drive out all of the Canaanites from their territory. Verse 29, nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites, which dwelt in their land. Verse 30, nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of parts of their territory. Nor did Asher in verse 31, nor did Naphtali in verse 33. And in fact, when you get to verse 34, Dan was actually driven back, and they lost some of their territory to the Canaanites that were still in the area. So what went wrong? Why was Israel not able to complete the job that God promised that he would? He did his part, we're told. Israel was left to do theirs, but they were not able to drive all of the Canaanites out of the land. Chapter 2 of Judges, verse 1. Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal. Now, we've noted that the angel of the Lord is a reference to the one who became Jesus Christ, appearing as a messenger to speak to the people. He says, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars. These were the really very clear commands that God had given to Israel. But, it says in verse 3, you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore, I also said, I will not drive them out from before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. So Israel did not do their part. God did everything that he promised he would do. He put them in a position to fully take over the land of Canaan, but they failed to do so. Just as God had warned, the people of Israel were seduced by the pagan gods of the land and the people of the land. And because of that, God would not deliver them any further from the remaining inhabitants of the land. Makes you wonder, how different might things have been if Israel had finished the job that was before them? If they had driven out, eliminated all of the Canaanites as God had told them that they should do, things certainly would have gone very differently for Judah, for Israel, and for all of those in the descendants that he was dealing with. Well, it's not God's fault. God didn't fail, but the Israelites failed to do their part. And that's part of the reason why the circumstances continue as they are today. Verse 10 in Judges 2. So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Eternal which he had done for Israel. You know, there's a certain kind of a flow to the behavior of people. The people were, in general, faithful to God as long as Joshua was alive and as long as the elders who served with Joshua were alive. But beyond that, we see there were serious problems. Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Eternal, died at the age of 110. They buried him within the border of his inheritance. Verse 10, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Eternal nor the work which he had done for Israel. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Baal, and they forsook the Lord God of their fathers. Just as God had warned, because of their failure to completely eliminate the Canaanites, because of their failure to obey God faithfully, because of their failure to do their part of upholding the covenant with God, Israel turned against God and began to worship the gods of the land. How did they forget so quickly? The first generation of Egypt that came out of Egypt died in the wilderness. The second generation that had grown up in the wilderness conquered Canaan, at least mostly. And the third generation forgot the true God and worshiped the false gods of the people who were supposed to have been destroyed. Over the next several hundred years, God remained faithful to his covenant. The history of Israel continues as we see through the books of Judges and then into the books of the Kings. God was faithful to his covenant, but the descendants of Abraham through Israel were never faithful to God. I guess I won't say never, but as a nation, they were not faithful to God. So when we continue, we'll see that Israel and Judah were warned and they were given the opportunity to repent, but instead they refused and were punished. The warnings that were given to ancient Israel and Judah include lessons for us today and give us prophetic insight into what the future holds in general for the descendants of Abraham and for the world in general, again, especially in the Middle East. We'll pick it up there as we continue.
For our last hymn, brethren, if you would pick up your songbooks and please stand, we'll turn to hymn number one. Hymn number one, I Sing the Mighty Power of God. After this, I'd like to ask Mr. Don Pavlik to come forward to close services with prayer. Hymn number one.
Almighty God, great eternal Father in heaven, we come before you today giving you thanks for the Sabbath, this closing service that we have here that has educated us on the winds of this world, of that prince of the air, who's definitely showing his signs and his strength, influencing the society that we live in today, but all around the whole world. We ask that you please strengthen us and help us draw closer to you so that we can embody your way, your truth, and learn from the understanding of the history of Israel on how they've gone through and have you kept your promise and show your might and your power and your strength, that it is nothing compared to out there. So let us draw closer to you. We ask also that you please heal those that are not able to make it here today, so that we all can gather again tomorrow, our next Sabbath, here together and draw closer again and build up those family ties and continue to draw closer to you and embody your way of life. We give you thanks for all these things and ask all these things in your Son, our Savior, soon coming King, Jesus Christ. Amen.